what slavery did in Canada was that it made race. It created race.
I'm Paul Kennedy. Welcome to Ideas.
So if we're looking at one of the legacies of slavery, it's this race making. It made white people white, it made black people black.
Historian Afua Cooper.
And in doing so, it created black inferiority, black subjugation, white supremacy, and white hegemony that we are still living with to this day. So again, Canada was not hermetically sealed away from the rest of the world and tucked in another corner. It participated.
Yes, Canada participated in slavery. Yet many of us are ignorant of this history. Instead, we've been taught a much sanitized, minimized version. Our narrative generally goes like this. A group of British loyalists were allowed to keep their slaves when they fled to colonial Canada, but the number of enslaved people were few, and Canada was more a place of freedom than enslavement. Here's the truth. For 200 years, thousands of African and Indigenous people were brutally forced into slavery in colonial Canada. But this is all but missing from our history books, our museums, our collective narrative. Artist and activist Camille Turner.
There is a real reluctance to name or to acknowledge that these people existed.
The enslavement of black and Indigenous people didn't end there. Segregation followed, along with widespread, even institutional racism. Art historian Charmaine Nelson.
When slavery gets abolished, racism doesn't die. The people who were owning slaves, the people who were owning the merchant ships, they still had the power, right? And we know in Canada, it took like 100 years or more for our courts to start knocking down the right of white Canadians to discriminate on the basis of race. Like, they upheld the same discursive structure, racist structure that underpins slavery.
To be black in this country, for me, and I'm sure other people too, you look over your shoulder all the time. You are aware of what you say. You're aware of where you are and at what time of day or night, really. You have to be justifying your existence or the reason you're in such a particular place.
You keep track of where you are at what time. You have a sense of an alibi in case. Because you are consciously or otherwise keeping in mind. You're keeping track of your movements just in case someone questions
just
you?
Just in case someone's questioning. We are probably the most surveilled community in all of Canada. The black people are under such surveillance in this country. We don't experience democracy or citizenship the same way that many groups in this country experience it.
This is the second of a two-part series exploring the history and legacy of slavery in Canada, by Ideas contributor Kyle G. Brown. We're calling today's program Slavery's Long Shadow, the Impact of 200 Years of Enslavement in Canada.
I'm in Toronto, a city that possesses a layer of history that's invisible to the eye. Many of its streets are named after once powerful men, but the slaves that some of them owned lived and died in anonymity. Natasha Henry is president of the Ontario Black History Society.
In this vicinity, there was a building where the Solicitor General Robert Gray resided when he took up his post beginning in 1800.
We're near Union Station at York and Wellington. Tall glass and steel buildings dominate the skyline. And at the northwest corner is a marble skyscraper, a world away from the homes of 19th century York.
And so he moved from Cornwall here to York, which was what Toronto was called then, and he moved with his two male servants.
And servants being a synonym for slave, or was there some distinction?
Well, they were his slaves. He inherited them from his father, James Gray. So Simon Baker and John Baker were then enslaved by Robert Gray.
And do we know what kind of work they did there at the time?
What's interesting is that John Baker was interviewed later on in his life, and so we were able to learn about what exactly he did as a young person enslaved in the province at that time. And so he describes his life as working as personal servants for James Gray and then later for the son, Robert Gray. And so that entailed, you know, following along with his owners, carrying bags, doing all kinds of domestic chores as was needed.
Any description as to the conditions of labor, the conditions of life?
John does briefly describe that he said that when they were living in Cornwall with the father, James Gray, that he was strict and that sometimes they would be punished and disciplined. They would be beaten sometimes if things were not done correctly.
Canada's archives are riddled with examples of brutality toward the enslaved. Rapes, missing digits, beatings, loss of life. Matthew Elliott, a loyalist in Upper Canada, had more than 60 slaves and a whipping post on his property. And as we mentioned in part one, 3/4 of enslaved people died by the age of 20 in New France. Yet slavery in colonial Canada has been characterized as somehow gentler.
I take the view that slavery was not a pastoral event, but rather one of organized viciousness.
A viciousness with long-lasting ramifications. A growing body of research indicates that historical atrocities can have ripple effects across generations. George Eliot Clark, poet and professor of Canadian literature at the University of Toronto.
I do find this thesis compelling, and I can think about it in terms of my own family. My mother's first cousins, once removed, George and Rufus Hamilton, who died at the ages of 22 and 23, both very young, were hanged for murder and robbery in Fredericton, New Brunswick in 1949. The Hamilton family apparently came from a plantation in Georgia. John Hamilton was the owner of our ancestors. And apparently Mr. Hamilton was one of those really vicious, violent slave masters. I have a line in my execution poems from a poem called The Killing, and it goes like this. A white man's whip turned into a black man's hammer because the murder that George and Rufus were condemned for having committed was in fact committed with a hammer. And my argument poetically is that their wielding of the hammer was, in my opinion, the result of their ancestors having been whipped and tortured and raped on the Hamilton plantation in Georgia. So 2 centuries before, or a century and a half before, and that the violence that George and Rufus executed themselves against an innocent white victim, in my mind, was the result of a century and a half of enslavement, and then after enslavement, de facto segregation and economic repression, suppression, educational segregation as well, even in colonial Canada and then in mid-20th century Nova Scotia and New Brunswick. And this was their heritage. And they ended up acting out against it their entire very short lives. George Rufus Hamilton were in and out of prison their entire lives. And I should mention very quickly, I'm also related to a minister or two and also a great contralto artist, Portia White. So on one hand, criminals, convicted, hanged criminals. And on the other hand, people who really struggled to achieve a success, no matter the oppression that they faced. And I think that's a double heritage of most descendants of people who were brutalized and made into beasts of burden and raped to produce more capital, more property for the slaveholder.
Back in downtown Toronto, I resume my tour with Natasha Henry, who's pointing out signs and landmarks dedicated to men whose fortunes were built in part on slavery. She's looking for one small plaque in particular, easy to miss at this busy intersection.
Oh, this is it. This is the property that was once owned by William Jarvis, once the provincial secretary of the Legislative Assembly.
William Jarvis was born in 1756. He fled Connecticut during the American Revolution, and upon arriving in Upper Canada, he was given a plum political post and 100 acres of land. On it, the family had a road built, known to this day as Jarvis Street.
This was one of the many land grants that he received. And William Jarvis, he enslaved at least 6 blacks. We know that because in the early Town of York censuses, those who were enslaved in the town were enumerated in the census. And so William Jarvis owned 6 slaves. One of his slaves, Henry Lewis, was able to escape to New York and got his freedom and wrote a letter back to William Jarvis asking to purchase himself so that he wouldn't have any issues in regards to his status. And William Jarvis seems to have granted that request and accepted a certain amount of money in order for Henry Lewis to be manumitted.
Now, this is all extraordinary history, but none of which can be read on any of these plaques. Here, as we arrive on the corner of Sherbourne and Adelaide in downtown Toronto, we see instead a pretty anodyne plaque reading, "These two attached houses are rare examples of Georgian-style residences that used to be common in Toronto," etc. No word of the history of this area, much less of the history of slavery.
Yes, you're correct in that a lot of these markers that acknowledge some of these early white settlers do not mention that many of them were slave owners. So a lot of that history is erased. If it's not mentioned in relation to their names, then these stories, the stories of the enslaved, gets lost, unfortunately. But we do know that there's documentation and that there's there seems to be an intentional act of excluding those aspects of the personal stories of these enslavers.
The Jarvises opposed abolition efforts that were gaining traction in the early 1800s. And as late as 1811, they petitioned the courts to punish 2 of his slaves whom he accused of stealing.
In another instance, one of his female slaves was again jailed for attempting to run away, and she said that she would rather stay in jail and be whipped rather than to return to her master, William Jarvis. She had the choice of going back to her owner and apologizing and having the whipping revoked, but she preferred to stay incarcerated in jail. So that speaks volumes to the conditions that she and the other slaves had to endure. So the documentation is there. So there's the choice of excluding these, I guess, unsavory aspects of their past from their stories.
One shudders to imagine what was happening in the Jarvis household for Kitty to ask to stay in prison. But little else is known about Jarvis's slaves, and certainly no plaque for them. As for those who benefited from slavery, and the state that allowed it, do we have the moral right to judge them retroactively?
I believe it is our moral duty to judge the state back then.
Charmaine Nelson is professor of art history at McGill University in Montreal.
The other thing is, too, you know, enslavers must have known there was an intimacy imposed upon Africans, especially in plantation context and in the North, too, in minority context. It was like, here, suckle my child, right? Black women were forced to be wet nurses to white children. Black children became surrogate mothers to white children. Upper class white women in the 18th and 19th century did not feed their children, did not take care of their children until the children were older. They would hand them off to wet nurses or nurses, often who were black women. So the intimacy that was forced in terms of sexual violence, in terms of biological exchange, it's crazy. So we actually forced us to become part of their family. Literally, all these white men would rape or sexually coerce black women to have mixed race children who they then often just kept enslaving. They didn't necessarily free them. So they knew it was wrong. They could see up close the damage they were doing, even in terms of things like life expectancy. Africans who were enslaved, indigenous people who were enslaved, had far shorter lifespans, of course, because they were being worked to death. So they knew exactly what they were doing. They actually wrote down the regimes of punishment, corporal control, you know, the breeding. They'd have breeding ledgers. So they knew intimately precisely what they were doing to this group of people. So, for me, yes, they should be held to account.
Various forms of bondage have existed for thousands of years, defended by philosophers such as Aristotle.
That some should rule and others be ruled is a thing not only necessary, but expedient. From the hour of their birth, some are marked out for subjection, others for rule. Some men are by nature free, and others slaves, and that for these latter, slavery is both expedient and right.
But slavery also had its opponents, including when it was rampant across the Americas in the 17th to 19th centuries.
When slavery existed, there were always people who were abolitionists, too. There were always people who could see through it and see that it was wrong and saw that when you whipped the enslaved person, they bled. They bled just like the white person if a white person had been whipped. And they cried out just like the white person would have cried out. So what would justify that?
I would say there was always a tension between those who supported slavery and those who opposed it.
Brett Rushforth is chair of the History Department at the University of Oregon.
There was never a moment, in my view, where you can say slavery was accepted by everyone at that time. That's a way to absolve people of moral responsibility when at every time there were voices speaking out against slavery. That's especially true when we consider the enslaved themselves. Enslaved people always, every day, for all of their lives, fought against the morality of slavery. They ran away. They resisted. They risked their lives. They sought to protect their families. And in those small acts, they stated day after day, this is an immoral system. So the largest problem with making the claim that no one questioned slavery is that it completely cuts out enslaved people as people. They all rejected slavery as a system of morality. And in many cases, that meant that a majority of people in any given colony vocally rejected slavery. So unless we're willing to silence or re-silence enslaved people, we have to acknowledge that slavery was always a controversial topic. But even if you limit your inquiry into European intellectuals or European lawmakers or the elite and the literate, there was always a debate going on. Jean Bodin in the late 16th century was one of many who was saying there should be no slavery in France because France is free soil and the king of France is the protector of liberty and that anyone who steps foot on the soil of France is free. That goes back actually all the way into the medieval period, those kinds of claims. And in fact, it was their acts, their demand that they were unjustly treated and unjustly enslaved that led to abolition becoming successful ultimately.
Nova Scotia is home to some of the oldest black settlements in Canada. Many first arrived on the shores of Shelburne in the 1780s, including some 3,500 Africans and African Americans who fought with the British during the American War of Independence. Most were slaves, their names recorded in the Book of Negroes, a ledger kept by British authorities. In exchange for their loyalty to the crown, they were promised freedom. The largest free black settlement in the 1780s was in Birchtown, on the shores of Shelburne Harbour. And today, it's also home to the Black Loyalist Heritage Centre and Historical Site, where I arranged to meet Vanessa Fells, who is a program coordinator there.
And you're also a lifelong student of African history, right? And African-Canadian history?
Very much so, lifelong student. Since a very young age, my parents have tried to teach me about black history, mainly because it wasn't taught in the school system. So probably from the age of about 12 or 13, I've been, a lifelong student now, learning about my history and culture and heritage. While Canada seems like this sunshine place that's always wonderful, you know, there is this deep-seated racial and racist tendencies in our history that we don't really talk about that much. And, you know, it happens in our African-Canadian community as well as our First Nations community. And people like to shy away from it because it's difficult to talk about. And so, you know, I wanted to bring that to the forefront and say, hey, we're not so different than our cousins to the south. We had segregation, we had slavery, these things actually happened. Let's talk about them, let's open this dialogue and have this conversation.
A group of tourists has arrived. At one point, the topic of slavery in Canada comes up, to the surprise of a young American.
Was slavery ever legal in Canada?
Yes.
Okay.
Slavery was legal in Canada. They actually used to sell slaves in Halifax, right off the auction block, as well as just down the road in Tuscott, Nova Scotia, which is about 35, 40 minutes from here.
Okay, so, when would that have been?
That was probably in the 16 and 1700s, a little bit in the 1800s.
Yeah, I was curious.
And was this the first time that you've heard about slavery existing in Canada?
Yeah.
Loyalists were promised land by the British when they arrived in Upper and Lower Canada and the Maritimes. White Loyalists were given rich farmland. The Black Loyalists were given land of little use, or none at all. In a struggle to survive, some were forced into servitude that was not unlike the slavery they had just escaped. And Black Loyalists who did find freedom discovered a hostile and racially charged environment. Vanessa Fells takes me along gravel paths and up a dirt trail into the forest nearby, where Black Loyalists spent their first winters in the 1780s.
Here, this is the pit house. So what actually happened is, when the Black Loyalists came and they were promised this land that they could farm on with houses, what they got, as you can see, is this rocky land on the shores of an ocean, really. And unfortunately, it's in the woods. They couldn't farm at all, and they had nowhere to live. So they ended up digging holes in the ground, and they made this makeshift shelter, which is called a pit house. And so, if you can imagine, in 1783, as cold as it was, this is where they actually lived. And many of them lived here for many, many years.
So it is a hole in the ground with kind of log structure. It's no more complicated than a series of logs cut and forming a triangle, kind of a what you'd call a lean-to or a really makeshift shelter that they had to endure winters with.
Yes. And in 1784, the British government actually cut funding off to the town of Shelburne and the White Loyalists. The White Loyalists, of course, got extremely angry and they had to blame somebody, but instead of blaming the British government and the king, they blamed Black Loyalists. So they actually marched to Birchtown in the middle of the night and burned the town to the ground. So they burned all the pit houses, and it's actually known as the first race riot that ever happened in all of North America. And so the Black Loyalists persevered even through all that, and they rebuilt their pit houses, and many of them stayed until 1792, when many of them couldn't take it anymore, and then some of them, of course, left and journeyed to Sierra Leone.
At the pit house, Vanessa and I run into Jenny Santamoro, the American tourist we met earlier, and her friend, Elisa Mazur.
Did you see the pit house?
Yeah,
I did.
That was a little terrifying.
Yeah?
Yeah, it was
real
very
simple.
Scary.
Imagine 1783 in the winter.
No, I can't. You're really here. You would really want to.
They let the Loyalists arrive in late August 1783, and back then, of course, winter came like September, October.
Oh, yeah, that's sudden.
So they had weeks before winter actually set in.
Now that you've been discovering bits and pieces of Canadian history, this particular darker chapter of Canadian history, what's your reaction?
I guess we were talking about how in America there's this perception that maybe Canada doesn't have as dark of a history or these dark parts of the history. So maybe just learning that this kind of stuff happens everywhere, can happen everywhere.
The racism and like talking about prioritizing the white loyalists, giving them land, and then giving Black Loyalists like the scraps is...
I don't know if Caitlin actually told you, but when the Loyalists came in 1783, they settled out here, and then a year later, the British Empire actually cut off funding to all of the Loyalists. And so the White Loyalists got mad, and instead of blaming the British Empire, they blamed the Black Loyalists. So they came here, and they burned Birchtown to the ground and all the pit houses.
And what actually was the arson? She mentioned some arson. Is that the arson that she mentioned? Or was that in the 90s?
No. In 2006, where you see the cars parked just out here, the parking lot, is where actually the old museum stood. It was what we called the office building. The old office building did burn down to the ground. They lost a lot of our artifacts. Mm-hmm. And so
Was never explained.
No, it was never actually explained. It was never proven. They did an investigation, but unfortunately they couldn't prove arson, but it was just been suspected of being arson.
The RCMP said the fire was likely deliberately set. Members of the Black Loyalist Heritage Society believe it was a hate crime. 18 years of research, along with the invaluable archives, were destroyed when the museum burned to the ground in 2006. a man was charged with arson, but charges were stayed due to a lack of evidence and because a witness refused to testify. 9 years later, in 2015, a new multi-million dollar center opened its doors. Up the stairs on the roof of the center, Vanessa shows me a large map of African-Canadian communities across Nova Scotia. Crisscrossing it is a long history of segregation.
Of course, after slavery ended, much like the United States, we did have segregation. And here, you know, it was multi-leveled. So not only did we have, like as I said before, we had segregated schools, we had segregated movie theaters, we had segregated cemeteries. If you bring up a map of the black communities, you can see that they were actually segregated geographically as well. And so you will have the large cities such as Halifax or even Shelburne, and then you will have the smaller black community, which is segregated sometimes, you know, 10 to 15 kilometers outside of the city. That was strategically done, although no one has ever come out and actually said that. Of course it was strategically done. They didn't actually want the black loyalists as well as the Jamaican Maroons, you know, the black refugees who came here to Nova Scotia. They didn't actually want them in their towns and cities. And so they put them sort of out of the way where they could forget about them. But of course, you know, we survived and we moved to the cities anyway. Canada tends to be a more subtle country when it comes to racism, but we do have some that are just completely out and in your face.
A cross burning shocked residents of Hans County and the entire country. Now police say they know who.
In 2010, we had a cross burning, which was like a 2 meter high cross that was burning on an interracial couple's lawn here in Nova Scotia. And we also had a noose that was tied to the door of our African Nova Scotian studies teacher in Bridgewater, Nova Scotia. In Halifax, currently, they have what is called stop and search, where the police can stop anyone and search them if they feel they are breaking the law in any way.
A recent CBC investigation in Halifax found that black people are subjected to police checks 3 times more often than whites.
And so, to me, there's your manifestation right there of the racial problems and the racism that exists in Canada.
And during recent provincial elections in Nova Scotia, campaign signs in the historic black community of North Preston were vandalized with racist graffiti.
We found election signs that had to do with our African Nova Scotian candidates, and they were spray painted with swastikas and with a monkey. And the numbers 1488, which alludes to the neo-Nazis and the neo-Nazis Aryan Nation group. When you have racist incidences that happen and those are so in your face, it kind of sends a shockwave through the Nova Scotian society as a whole, because, as I said, many of them like to believe that this is Canada and such a nice place and we don't have racism. But, you know, when these incidences keep happening, it's becoming harder and harder for people to kind of deny that that is actually, it's inherent within our society.
Yet many remain unaware of the link between Canada's past slavery and present-day racism and discrimination. Charmaine Nelson.
If anyone's paying attention to the daily news media, you'll see that black people are being surveilled and over-policed and carded and whatever languages are being used in different places, Toronto, New York, Montreal, etc., at a rate that's disproportionate to other, especially white citizens. So we're still subjected to a heightened surveillance on the basis of our race. And that, where did that come from? This is slavery. What do you think slavery looked like? How do you think they could catch fugitives if not to have networks of people who are willing to put their necks on the line to catch people for a reward? Where did, you know, I always say to people when they want to talk about policing and don't want to hear what I have to say, but it's like policing to a large extent rose out of slave patrols. That was the architecture of policing. So today, amongst black people, amongst ourselves, we talk about things like walking while black, getting the jaywalking ticket when you're crossing the street with 5 white people and the police just pick you to give you a ticket. Disproportionate rates of charges being applied to black citizens in terms of marijuana when compared to white Canadians in the same context.
George Elliott Clark.
I mean, sooner or later, 35 million of us have to begin connecting the dots. If there are problems in Thunder Bay involving Native people, problems with the Sûreté du Québec involving Native women in parts of Quebec, problems involving the stopping of black men in Toronto or in Edmonton or in Halifax or in other cities all across the country, not to mention police shootings of unarmed black men, often fatally, or the beatings of black youth without apparent cause, Yeah, no, folks, we got to start connecting the dots and realize that one of the heritages of slavery is the attitude that police have themselves carried forward genetically through many generations of especially men and sometimes women in uniform, that their basic job is to police us, is to police Black and brown people. And when I say Black and brown people, I mean also I'm including Indigenous people as well.
During slavery, the Black body was property.
Afua Cooper is chair of Black Canadian Studies at Dalhousie University in Halifax.
The Black body could be beaten down, stomped down, hanged, dismembered, raped, castrated, whatever, because the Black body was property. And this is how you deal violence. Violence was an integral part of maintaining slavery. And so I am positing that today in the psyche of some of these people who are in law enforcement, Black people is still chattel. Black people is still property. Black people is without protection. So you can follow somebody, even though they are coming home from school or from work, and then stomp them down, beat them down, dismember them, kill them, because you feel like you have a right. You have a right to do that. Because this idea of Blackness in your mind, that in the psyche of Western people, of Western society, that goes back to maybe 1,000 years, certainly 500 years, is still there. And when you peel back the layer of consciousness, there it is. There it is.
Whether they're conscious of it or not.
Whether they're conscious of it or not. Because it is endemic to the psyche of the West.
You're listening to Ideas on CBC Radio 1, on the CBC Radio app, on Sirius XM, and at cbc.ca/ideas, where you can also sign up for our podcasts. I'm Paul Kennedy. We're calling today's program Slavery's Long Shadow, the Impact of 200 Years of Enslavement in Canada. It's a commonly held belief the slavery practice during the 17th to 19th centuries was the sinister business of other nations, that our country, for the most part, was the land of freedom for Blacks. But this would be false. Enslavement, the trade in human beings, took place in the birthplace of Canada. Unbeknownst to many, and often unnoted in our history books, thousands of Indigenous and African people were forced into slavery in this country. This is the second in a two-part series on slavery and its aftermath by contributor Kyle G. Brown. And as a bonus, we've commissioned two poems for this series by poet George Eliot Clark. You can hear them at our website.
In making this documentary, there's a question that I've avoided for a long time. I finally decide to face it with Afua Cooper.
As a Jamaican, do you take any of this personally? Now, I ask that question for two reasons. One, because you've spent most of your professional life studying these issues. But also, I'm half Jamaican. I wonder, are we the descendants of slaves?
Well, we are descendants of slaves. I mean, when Britain abolished, so-called abolished slavery in 1834, August 1st, 1834, in the British slave colonies, including Jamaica, several hundred, maybe 600,000, close to 700,000 of those enslaved people were in Jamaica, were in the island of Jamaica. So these are our ancestors. So we are descended from slaves.
Because I've been hesitant to look into my ancestry, actually, mm-hmm. for this very reason. Mm-hmm. I'm afraid of what I'll find. The idea, for example, that I'm a descendant of slaves, potentially. I find it a disturbing possibility.
Why? Why do you find it disturbing?
Uh, I wonder if the trauma that we're talking about, that passes from generation to generation, is at work in me. I wonder if that's one of the things that influences my worldview, the way I deal with authority, my rage. I wonder if it's rooted in the trauma that can perhaps be traced back to just this kind of historical atrocity. Does it ever play on your mind, the your emotional and personal world as it may relate to your academic work?
Well, you know, yes and no. No in the sense that as a trained historian, as a professional, I can go and I can examine these documents, these artifacts, and create research notes and data and so forth. Yes, because, you know, I told you about I needed to go to a particular place. And as a Black woman, I think it was unsafe for me to be driving by herself. So here I am, this scholar working with these documents. You know, white scholars don't have to deal with that. They don't have to deal with, like, racial trauma or the potential of racial assault while doing research. But we do. We deal with that possibility. Or driving through, whether rural or urban, Nova Scotia or Ontario or Quebec, and being attacked verbally, being called the N-word, that kind of thing. That's traumatic.
That's happened to you?
Oh, yes. That's happened to me. So, you know, wherever we go, there we are. Wherever we go with our bodies. And our bodies are marked in specific ways. Our bodies are rooted in a particular history.
The history of slavery in colonial Canada has long been ignored, and so has much of its legacy: segregation, institutional racism. For generations, they've been all but absent from our textbooks. Vanessa Fells from the Black Loyalist Heritage Society.
People like to think of Canada through rose-colored glasses, like it wasn't the same as the United States. And it very much was. We had the same issues. I mean, some of those issues still go on today, especially in terms of slavery. Yes, we had slavery. When I go into the schools, I mean, we have teachers, history teachers, who will say, wow, they actually sold slaves, you know, on the auction blocks in Halifax. And I can say, you can go to the National Archives and find advertisements for runaway slaves and advertisements for them selling slaves.
So you're walking into elementary schools, secondary schools, and you're meeting history teachers who do not know that slavery took place in Canada.
Yes. Many of them have absolutely no idea. And like I said, it's not in our history books. To this day, we still have history books that don't actually say there was slavery in Canada. And I find that jaw-dropping. But at the same time, when I was a kid in junior high and in high school, you know, in the 90s, it wasn't in the history books either. And so for me, it's up to us as African Nova Scotians and African Canadians to challenge those education pieces and to challenge our departments of education and say, look, this happened. We need to talk about it. We need to stop shying away and trying to sort of sweep it under the rug and not talk about these horrible things. It's frustrating because it gives the sense, at least to the African Canadian community, that they don't care. That plays into the whole ideal of self-esteem and self-worth. Because if you're saying, as the Canadian education system and society as a whole doesn't bring forth or help to bring forth this history, it's telling you your self-worth is much less than other people within our society.
Provinces have recently revised their school curricula to cover more of the Black and Indigenous Canadian experience, but the change has been patchy. Charmaine Nelson teaches at McGill University.
So within my little world, I see that I am making impact. Now, in the broader world, though, it's a different issue because, you know, I say to the students, if you in this class, when you come into my class called the Visual Culture of Slavery, do not know that slavery happened in Canada, and you people are getting higher educations, what do you think would happen if we walked down to Sherbrooke Street and stopped 10 Canadians and asked them if they know if slavery happened in Canada? Like, we'd be lucky to get 1 in 10. That knew. And how are they supposed to know? Because they too might have gone through SAGEP or high school, even university. And again, who's going to teach them? There's not many people like me who are teaching. There's quite a few people who teach slavery in, let's say, Canadian academia, but a lot of them would be teaching those tropical, semi-tropical contexts. They're not Canadianists. There's just a handful of us who focus on Canadian slavery, who could bring that into Canadian academia.
Historian Natasha Henry is working with educators to improve the teaching of Black history in Ontario.
More and more, we're getting more resources in regards to diversifying the presentation of Canadian history. However, there's a big gap in terms of the knowledge base of teachers. And so we have a situation where we may have teachers who have only learned certain aspects of Canadian history, who are then in turn reproducing the same kind of knowledge or knowledge gap in their classrooms. So as it relates specifically to teaching about slavery in Canada, that's something that is quite new. It's only in this most recent curriculum document, which came out in 2013, where the topic of slavery was actually included in the learning expectation, and it's still an optional topic. And so here we are in the 21st century trying to figure out how to teach about slavery in Canada. So we're really far behind the United States.
And yet the relevance of this history, the history of slavery in Canada, is at times questioned, including by some students of historian and McGill University professor Charmaine Nelson. So she's come up with an assignment.
Within the class, I say to them, go home and talk to your family and ask them some questions. Because I said, listen, slavery is not a Black history. Slavery is a global history. I said, who are the ship's captains? Who are the slave owners? Who are the persons printing the fugitive slave ads? Who are the merchants, right? They're all white people. So I said, if our ancestry goes, you know, you have the grandparents, then the great, right? 4, 8, 16, 32, 64. I'm like, please, you're telling me you're not going to hit someone who's implicated by slavery directly or indirectly? Go home and ask some questions. And I had, amazing, I had one student so brave. She came back and she said, Professor Nelson, I got to share this with you. I went home and asked some questions, like you said. My parents or my elders told me that I have an ancestor who was the governor of Virginia.
Oh.
Thank you. The guy held some slaves, okay? Come on. And she never knew this. No one had ever told her this. It was just a big family secret.
And all it took was a question to break it open.
Just thank you. And then, of course, I had other people who went home and found out they had indentured servitude in their family, and they're hiding this like a dirty secret. I said, are you kidding me? If your ancestor hadn't survived that contract, you would not be here, my friend. You got to change your mind about what that means to have someone who survived that, because indentureship was not pleasant, to say the least.
But this doesn't stop people to this day from dismissing the horrors of slavery.
You know, when you hear about slavery for 400 years, for 400 years, that sounds like a choice.
Like Kanye West created a media storm when he suggested slaves chose to stay in bondage. McGraw-Hill Education issued an apology in 2015 when a U.S. textbook referred to slaves as simply workers. In 2003, the Quebec author of a book about the slave-owning Luke family was berated online by locals who ridiculed his findings. Britain's Treasury Department caused a scandal when it tweeted this, the latest in its series of fun facts.
Did you know? In 1833, Britain used £20 million, 40% of its national budget, to buy freedom for all slaves in the empire. The amount of money borrowed for the Slavery Abolition Act was so large that it wasn't paid off until 2015, which means that living British citizens helped pay to end the slave trade.
African Caribbean communities resented the implication that British taxpayers ended slavery, and not abolition campaigning and resistance. It was also a reminder that in the end, it wasn't the slaves who were compensated, but slave masters. A point raised by reparations campaigners like Sikaya Thomas of the Global African Congress in Toronto.
And as far as I'm concerned, slavery was simply the worst crime against humanity in all of human history. And for a long time, Canada have gotten away with that level of ignorance. So when you begin to talk about slavery, some people just genuinely don't know. But the other people are not prepared to even look at the evidence to look at where slavery existed, who owned the slave, and begin to talk about the question of reparation.
One of the first things that occurs to people when they hear about reparations, one of the first things they imagine in their mind, is the dollar sign. They imagine that it's all about money, trying to reclaim some of the wealth lost. What do you say to these people?
Well, I understand why that comes to mind. When Germany paid the Jews for the Holocaust, money came into being. When the Japanese was paid in Canada, money came to mind. So there's a pattern, there's a history where money, financial compensation is one aspect of the reparation. But for blacks, it's much, much larger than this. Because don't forget, the period of time our enslavement lasts, the consequences and the many multidimensional parts of the of what happened in enslavement. So it is not just an issue that money can fix for us. It's also rewriting the history book. That's very, very important. It begin to look at the impact on our health. It's begin to look how we as people, the descendants of enslaved, have internalized that whole experience. How we look at each other, how we relate to each other, how easy it is for us to get angry at each other. All of that are ramifications of the slave trade.
Thomas has appealed to Ottawa to investigate the role played by past Canadian governments in allowing slavery to continue. And historians and activists recently told the Senate Committee on Human Rights that the government should apologize and pay reparations to slave descendants. This, they say, would pave the way for the kind of reconciliation that has begun with Indigenous Canadians. George Elliott Clark.
We have to accept that, well, you know what? We're not superior to America. Yeah, we slaughtered fewer people. We don't have as public a policy of mass incarceration. So in that sense, we might want to think of ourselves as being superior. But I think that's a mistake. I think the ideal for 35 million Canadians is to have what Pierre Trudeau called a just society. And we don't get to a just society unless we admit that we have been unjust and continue to be unjust in some ways towards some groups. And I think if we really want to celebrate that ideal and fast forward 150 years to the 300th anniversary of the founding of Canada, I would like to think that by then we have achieved a just society that is the envy of the entire planet. But we're not going to get there if we adopt the attitude that there never has been an issue, there never has been a problem. As soon as we're able to decide that we can talk about and explore and correct those injustices, and I am in favor of reparations. For crying out loud, I am. I know the R word causes people to have heart attacks and so on. But let's face facts, folks. For hundreds of years, Western societies, imperialist and colonialist, benefited from land and resources seized from indigenous populations and from the forced labor of Africans.
If Canadians aren't very candid about their own history, or at least the less comfortable aspects of it, what do you think is the reason for that?
That we don't mind being lied to. We prefer a comfortable lie than hard, uncomfortable truths. If we really want to talk about justice for the injustices of the past, then sooner or later, money and maybe sometimes land has to change hands. It has to, if we're going to actually correct the injustices of the past. Just because an injustice is past doesn't mean it's no longer unjust. Folks have benefited from the injustices of the past. And now I think that it's necessary to repair those injustices by asking people to make good on the dues owed.
Do you think that one of the other reasons for Canadian sheepishness when it comes to discussing these kinds of things may be because there's almost a sense of collective guilt or guilt by association, the sense that if we start to admit that our forebears were responsible for some of the worst atrocities that we can imagine, it therefore touches on us as their descendants.
True, but guilt doesn't do any good. I want a check. I'm not interested in somebody saying I'm sorry. I want you to cut me a check. That's what make me feel good. Take that check to the bank. Make sure it doesn't bounce. Make sure there's some good resources behind that check. That would begin to make me feel like, okay, the suppression, oppression, repression of my ancestors has finally been recognized in the one way that capitalist societies understand. Settling that lawsuit, settling that tort, resolving that wrong.
Not only have there been no reparations to the descendants of slaves in Canada, there have also been no official apologies. apologies have been given to a number of groups wronged in the past, but not to the black community, and little consideration of how to move forward. Sikaya Thomas.
Money is not the only question. We have to begin to look at our own psychology and how are we going to repair it. Not necessarily with Western methodologies, but certainly with methodologies that look at it from an Afrocentric point of view, how we need to go about this repair process. So money is important, yes, but there's multiple other areas that must be addressed.
Artist and activist Camille Turner.
Unless we understand the past and to understand that we're living the legacy of the past, then we're not going to be able to address what's going on. So history to me is not just something that's dead and gone and, you know, let's move on. We need to grapple with this past. It has ramifications.
Ramifications that to this day cause great suffering. But voices are being raised, especially from the new generation of slave descendants. Vanessa Fells of the Black Loyalist Heritage Society in Birchtown, Nova Scotia.
When I go into schools and do presentations, I will always start with singing the Black National Anthem because, at least in North America, it is seen as our anthem.
Lift every voice and sing till earth and heaven ring.
The Black National Anthem, which is known as Lift Every Voice and Sing, was first written in the 1800s by a man named James Weldon Johnston.
Let our rejoicing rise high as the listening skies. Let it resound loud as a rolling sea.
It talks about struggle, but it talks about perseverance. And it also talks about remembering, like I said, our past and where we come from. The last line says, true to our God, true to our native land. So it's about remembering our history all the way back on the continent of Africa, and then remembering what has happened in our lives in the struggle, as well as the triumphs that we've had.
The rising sun of our new day begun. Let us march on till victory is won. God of our weary.
I mean, to not talk about these stories is essentially denying that they ever happened, and that can have a profound effect on a person of African descent who wants to learn about their history. You know, slavery happened, and they went through all these hardships, but they persevered. And we are their descendants today. And look at the great things that they've done. Now we have to pick up that torch and do it as well.
The light, keep us forever in the path, we pray. Lest our feet stray from the places, our God, where we met thee. Lest our hearts, drunk with the wine of the world, we forget thee. Shadowed beneath thy hand, may we forever stand. True to our God, true to our native land.
On Ideas, you've been listening to the documentary Slavery's Long Shadow, The Impact of 200 Years of Enslavement in Canada. This is the second in a two-part series on the hidden history of slavery in Canada and its aftermath by contributor Kyle G. Brown. We have additional material for this series on our website, cbc.ca/ideas, including videos of Canada's former poet laureate, George Eliot Clark, reading two powerful poems commissioned for this series. You can also follow Ideas on Facebook and on Twitter. The series was produced by Mary Link. Associate producer, Liz Nage. Technical production, Danielle Duval. The executive producer of Ideas is Greg Kelly. I'm Paul Kennedy.